Chapter 19. 31st of October, 2 a.m. 4 hours until low tide. "Why were you with us that Christmas?" Lily asks Connor when the film comes to an end. He answers without looking at her. "My father was in rehab again, and Nana offered to look after me." The silence that follows is smashed by the sound of the clocks in the hallway. It's 2 o'clock in the morning, and we all look exhausted, especially my mother. She takes a sip of cold tea. "Is there a way to turn off the clocks? I don't want them to wake Trixie," Lily says. "My niece has been so quiet, sleeping on the window seat at the back of the room, I'd almost forgotten that she was here. I'm surprised that the sound of the TV didn't wake her, never mind the clocks. But then I remember the sedative they put in Trixie's drink earlier. My mother's sleeping pills are strong enough to take out an elephant." Lily gets up from the sofa to check on her daughter. "Where is she?" Lily asks. "We're all up and out of our chairs within a matter of seconds. We stand and stare at the empty window seat and the blanket on the floor. "Where is Trixie?" Lily shrieks, asking the question a second time, but still nobody replies. She stares at each of our faces, looking for an answer. In the absence of one, we start searching the room, checking behind the sofas and curtains, but Trixie isn't here. "She's gone," Lily says. "I don't understand." Rose comes to her side, the protective older sister autopilot kicking in, their earlier squabble forgotten. "Try to stay calm. She can't have gone far. You know what teenagers are like. You used to be one." "I thought we'd put a sleeping pill in Trixie's tea," Nancy says. Lily turns on her. "We did. But that would have knocked her out for hours. Unless..." "Unless what?" Lily snaps.
"Someone moved her,"
Nancy whispers. "I don't understand how anyone could have moved Trixie without one of us seeing. But the window seat is in the far corner of the room, and we were all staring in the opposite direction at the TV. Plus, it's the middle of the night now, and we are exhausted with grief and tiredness. We all left the room earlier. Was Trixie here when we came back? Did anyone check?" Despite her mother's constant digs about her dress size, Trixie is a normal weight for a girl her age. If anything, I'd describe her as petite. Easy enough for an adult to lift. "I think it is possible that someone could have taken her, and knowing that makes me feel even worse, because at least one of us should have been keeping an eye on her." The clocks stop ringing in the hallway. Nobody speaks, but we all follow Lily as she rushes out of the lounge, through the hall and into the kitchen. She stands in front of the chalk wall, and when I see Nana's poem, I understand why. The following lines have been crossed out. "Daisy Darker's Nana was the oldest but least wise. The woman's will made them all feel ill, which was why she had to die. Daisy Darker's father lived life dancing to his own tune. His self-centered ways and the pianos he played danced him to his doom. Daisy Darker's niece was a precocious little child. Like all abandoned ducklings, she would not fare well in the wild." The part about Trixie has been crossed out.
"Oh my God!"
Lily whispers, staring at the chalk words and covering her nose and mouth with her hands as though praying to a god I know she does not believe in.
"It's coming true,"
she says quietly, then turns to look at us all.
"It's coming true."
"What's coming true?" my mother asks. Lily is shaking now. She points up at the poem, searches the faces of our family for any sign of understanding, and finds none. But I know exactly what she means, even if I'm too scared to say it out loud. There is a low rumble of thunder in the distance outside. I hadn't noticed how hard it was raining. The storm is getting closer, and the house feels bitterly cold. Lily's words tumble too quickly out of her mouth for the rest of the family to keep up.
Nana's poem on the wall. Can you not read it? Am I not making sense? It's a poem about us dying one by one. Nana is dead, Dad is dead, and now Trixie is...
Missing. She's just missing. We'll find her, says Rose.
It's just one of Nana's silly poems, says my mother.
How do you know that she wrote it? I don't think it looks like her handwriting. Anyone could have sneaked down here in the night and written a poem on the wall, Connor says unhelpfully, as though thinking out loud.
I remember the chalk I saw on his jeans earlier, and the way he quickly dusted it off. He's been quiet for a long time, and everyone turns to stare at him.
You're right, says Lily. Your name isn't up there. Maybe you wrote it.
Maybe we should stop wasting time and look for Trixie, I say. But before anyone can answer, there is another rumble of thunder, but this one is so much louder than the last. Nancy sways a little and grabs the side of the kitchen table to steady herself.
Are you okay? Rose asks.
I'm fine, honestly, Nancy says. It's a headache, and I'm just tired, like all of us. We need to find Trixie.
Why don't you lot check upstairs, and I'll carry on looking down here?
Good idea, says Lily.
She never listens to anyone except our mother.
Rose, Lily, Connor, and I run upstairs, calling Trixie's name, before each disappearing into a different bedroom to search. I start in the one Lily and Trixie shared last night. This used to be my sister's bedroom whenever they stayed at Seaglass when we were children. It's bigger than mine, but I suppose there were two of them. Everything is very much the same as it was then, with ghastly pink carpet, pink curtains, and floral wallpaper. My sisters were girly girls. I can still see the dark rectangles where they used to stick their posters when we were here for the summer holidays. Always boy bands for Lily, cute animals for Rose. There are two beds on opposite sides of the room, two little tables, two windows, and a wall of built-in wardrobes.
Trixie?
I whisper, but there's no reply. All I can hear is the rain lashing the window and the sea crashing against the rocks outside. This is still a room of two sides. Lily's bed is unmade, with clothes on the floor around it, and her bedside table is a mess of magazines and makeup, even though she's only been here for a few hours. On the other side of the room, and in stark contrast, Trixie's bed is neatly made. All I can see on her bedside table is an old book she must have borrowed from Nana's library and a glass of water. I get down on the floor and look beneath the beds, but there is nothing there. I hear another deep rumble of thunder in the distance and have an overwhelming urge to hide. Storms at Seaglass seem to be a regular occurrence when we were little girls, both the emotional and literal varieties. I remember being so scared by the sound of thunder outside, or shouting downstairs, that I would often run in here at night. Fear was one of the few things that seemed to unite me and my sisters when we were children. A storm at Seaglass is not the same as a storm in London, or anywhere else that I have lived. Being in a storm here, on this tiny island, feels like being on a rickety old ship in the middle of the sea, one that will surely sink if the waves get too high. We used to hide together under the beds in this room when life got too loud. Lily under one, Rose and I huddled under the other. Then we would count the number of seconds between the lightning and the inevitable thunder that followed, to know how many miles away it would strike. I find myself counting again now. One Mississippi, two Mississippi, three Mississippi. There were other times when a storm sneaked up on us in the night, when I would have to hide alone under my own bed in my room. but we could always hear one another counting through the walls in the darkness. The closer the storm got, the more frightened we became, as a flash of light lit up whichever room we were hiding in. I'm sure my sisters are probably sharing the same silent memories now. One Mississippi. Two Mississippi. The doors on the built-in wardrobes that line one wall of the room all have wooden slats. As I take one last look around, I'm convinced I see one of them move out of the corner of my eye. I stop and stand perfectly still, listening. "Trixie," I whisper. I hear something. "Trixie, are you in there?" The silence that follows suggests I must have imagined it. But then I hear what sounds like someone breathing, very quietly. I want to fling the doors open, but I'm scared of what I might find. A flash of lightning lights up the sky outside the window for a second time, and I think I hear something move behind the wardrobe doors again. It's impossible to ignore now, and I force my feet to take a step closer. I pretend that there is nothing to be afraid of, even though events so far tonight suggest otherwise. The wardrobe is within touching distance, and I slowly reach for the handle. Then there is another flash of lightning. One Mississippi. I don't get to two. The thunder claps as though eagerly applauding the show before it is over. The noise is almost instant and so loud that it seems to shake the house. The lights go out, and I am a child again, terrified in the darkness, too scared to move or make a sound. I tell myself it's just a power cut and try to stay calm. But then lightning strikes again. It illuminates everything, including the wardrobe doors, and I see two eyes between the slats staring right at me before the room goes black. Then the doors start to shake and rattle. Someone is trapped inside, and they want to get out. Chapter 20. 31st of October, 2:15 a.m. Less than 4 hours until low tide. It all happens so fast. The lightning, the eyes behind the wardrobe door, the darkness, and then the sound of Rose's voice right behind me in the room. "What are you doing in here?" she asks, and at first I think she means me. She has a torch, as though she knew the lights were going to go out, which she aims at the wardrobe before flinging the doors open. Poppins, the dog, jumps out, rushing towards us. She barks and wags her tail before licking Rose's hand. "Who put you in there?" Rose asks, and when the dog doesn't answer, they both turn to stare in my direction. "It wasn't me," I say. "There's no sign of Trixie in the other bedrooms," Connor says, appearing in the gloomy doorway. He holds up his hand to shield his eyes from the light when Rose points her torch at his face. "Where did you get that?" he asks. "When I checked Nancy's room, it was under the bed," says Rose. "I thought it might come in handy if the lights went out. They often do when there's a storm. And that wasn't all I found there. Trixie." Rose lowers her voice to a whisper. "No, this." Connor steps further into the room, and Rose produces a small floral bag. Connor shakes his head. "What is it?" "It's Lily's missing diabetic kit." "I thought she couldn't find it. What's it doing under your mother's bed?" "I don't know." The bedroom door squeaks, telling tales on the person behind it. We all turn and take a step back. I'm not the only one who is afraid now. And Rose's torch reveals Lily, standing on the landing. She has used her lighter to find her way in the dark and is still holding it up like someone at a pop concert. Her face looks strange, as though she can't quite see us. There's no sign of Trixie in Nana's bedroom. Did you find anything?
No, answers Rose before anyone else can.
Let's head back downstairs. Maybe Nancy might have had more luck.
Try not to worry. We will find Trixie.
Okay, Lily says, nodding, as though desperate for someone else to take charge. The habitual fight has gone out of her, and she seems broken. It's as though Lily's lights switched off when sea glasses did. Rose leads the way with her torch as we creep downstairs in the darkness. Our silent fear seems as loud as the storm outside. It's even colder down here now that the fire has almost burned itself out, but that isn't why we are huddled together in the lounge. Connor takes a candle from the mantelpiece and lights it, and we return to the window seat, the last place we all saw Trixie.
I don't understand. She was right here, Lily says, picking up the blanket and holding it to her nose, like a dog checking for scent.
We'll find her, says Rose, but from the tone of her voice, I'm not convinced she believes it.
You look pale. I found this upstairs. When did you last inject?
Lily takes the diabetic kit from her and unzips it straight away.
Hours ago. Where did you find it?
Rose stares at the floor. Nancy's room. For some reason, her answer sounds like a lie.
My insulin pen is missing, Lily says.
Time seems to stop again while we all catch up with life's latest plot twist.
Nancy?
Lily calls, but there is no answer. Our mother is now also nowhere to be found. We search the rest of the rooms downstairs together, with Poppins following us. I think she thought it was a game before, but now she walks with her tail between her legs and her ears back. I can't help wondering whether she might be able to hear something we can't. The thunder and lightning continue as we move through the house with just a torch and a candle, though the storm does at least seem to be moving further away.
Trixie!
Lily calls her daughter's name repeatedly. We all do, but there is no answer. We step inside the library. It is filled with Nana's books, crammed in no particular order into every available space on the shelves that line the room. The sofa shows no sign of where Rose slept on it earlier, but her overnight bag is in the corner. The room is cold and dark and empty. Rose leads the way to the kitchen next. It's obvious that the huge room at the back of the house is uninhabited too, but we take it in turns to look under the table, inside cupboards and behind curtains. Connor is taller than the rest of us, and accidentally walks into the black and orange paper chains Nana had decorated the ceiling with for Halloween. I feel as though we are going through the motions, scared of running out of places to search. And we are all trying not to look at the chalk poem written on the wall.
We should check Nana's studio, Rose says.
She and Lily exchange uncomfortable glances. I think because it is somewhere they were not allowed to go as children.
It's probably locked. Always used to be, says Lily,
walking towards the door. But when she tries the handle, it swings open with an eerie creak. Even in the dim light, we can all see that the studio has been ransacked.
Connor steps inside first. What the?
Maybe someone was looking for the book Nana said she was working on, Rose suggests, offering an answer before anyone had time to ask a question.
Or looking for Beatrice Darker author memorabilia they can flog on eBay,
Connor says. Rose ignores him. Nana said she was going to write one last book about all of us. Maybe that was something someone didn't want people to read. The studio, which always had an air of organized chaos, has been trashed. There are drawings and paper strewn all over the floor, drawers pulled out, pencils snapped in two, and paints knocked over. We walk through the mess from one end of the room to the other, and I notice some of the newer illustrations and poems on the wall. They're all very different, but all very Nana. This is where the story ends, of fractured families and forgotten friends, and people too blind to make amends. One of my favourite Nana sayings is painted in silver writing over a blue and black background of the sea. It always makes me think of sea glass, and of coming back here year after year. If you can't find your way back to happy, navigate to the place you know as less sad. I think Rose might be right. What if someone in the family wanted to find Nana's last book to stop anyone from publishing it? Says Connor. I think someone should stop playing detective, Lily says. But he carries on regardless. Nana was always hiding secret meanings in the poems she wrote. They were never really just for children. What if someone had secrets they didn't want shared? I say, agreeing with him. Secrets worth killing to keep, Connor adds. And that's why they killed her. One of the windows is open, and a gust of wind blows out the candle Connor is carrying. Can we please concentrate on trying to find my daughter? Lily says. Where is Nancy? I ask. But nobody replies. I think we're too scared of the answers silently auditioning inside our heads. My mother was always a proud and private person. We all know how much she would have hated the idea of someone writing the truth about her or her children, even disguised as fiction. The last little poem on the wall is accompanied by an illustration in Nana's familiar style. The watercolour silhouette is of three little girls holding hands. It was destined for her final book, the one about us, I'm sure of it. The room feels colder than before when I read the words. The same ones that were on the kitchen table earlier, but this time in Nana's swirly handwriting. Which makes me think that someone else found the illustration in here, copied the words, and left them on a scrap of paper in the other room for us to find. Trick or treat the children here, before they scream and disappear. I was never allowed to go trick or treating with my sisters when we were children. My mother said it was too risky. As a family, we always dressed up for Halloween. It was Nana's birthday, and she insisted. But then Rose and Lily would be allowed to go trick-or-treating with the rest of the local kids, and I would stay behind, jealous of all the fun they had and the sweets they brought home the next day. The tides meant that they always stayed with friends, unable to get back to sea glass until the sea retreated again. That was something else my sisters had that I didn't when we were children. Friends. I was never allowed to make any. Nana always tried to cheer me up with some secret sweets just for me, hidden around sea glass. While Rose and Lily were out having fun, I'd spend the evening with her, sitting by the fire, listening to her stories. She did not approve of trick-or-treating and would remind me why every year. What we see as innocent fun on Halloween originated as part of a pagan ritual where people dressed up in scary costumes on the 31st of October to frighten away the dead. They offered food or drink to try to appease them, which is where all the free candy and sweets originated from. In the Middle Ages, the ritual was known as mumming. By the time Christianity arrived in Europe, a new practice called souling was on the Halloween scene. Poor people would visit the houses of the rich and receive pastries called soul cakes in exchange for promises to pray for the homeowner's dead relatives. Scotland took the tradition and bent it a little more out of shape, encouraging young people to visit their neighbours' houses and sing a song, recite a poem, or perform another sort of trick before receiving a treat of nuts, fruit, or coins. The term trick-or-treating wasn't used until the 1920s in America, and Nana said it made a mockery of what started out as an important ritual. It bothered her a great deal that people were encouraged to fear the dead instead of honour them, and she'd always end her story with the same line. There's no need to be afraid of the dead. It's the living you have to watch out for. We leave Nana's studio together, none the wiser, and no closer to finding Trixie. The music room is the last place left to look. I think it turned out that way because none of us want to see my dead father again. Lightning strikes just before we open the door, and I automatically start counting. One Mississippi. The lightning lights up the room, and the shadow of the piano casts a dancing pattern over the walls. Two Mississippi. There is no sign of Trixie in here, either. Nothing out of place at all, apart from the missing piano key I spotted earlier. I remember middle C, and see that it's a B key that has gone. Three Mississippi. Then I realise that's not the only thing missing. My father's dead body has disappeared, just like Nana's did before. Connor steps forward. What the f-? Thunder rumbles in the distance, and we all stare at one another in the darkness. Our faces are mostly in shadow, but look equally scared. Lily steps closer to Rose and holds her hand the way she did when they were children. The rain that has been lashing the windows seems to pause for thought, and there are a few brief seconds of total silence. Until we all hear the sound of scratching, like nails on a chalkboard, out in the hall. Chapter 21. 31st of October. 2:25 a.m. Less than 4 hours until low tide. Connor snatches the torch from Rose's hand and rushes out into the hallway. None of us are far behind, and when we catch up, we see the source of the sound. Poppins is scratching at the cupboard under the stairs, and she starts to whimper. Lily steps forward and tries to open the door, but it's locked. Trixie, she calls, banging her fist against it. Are you in there? There is no answer. Lily bangs on the door again, louder this time, and the wooden door rattles on its elderly hinges. She shakes the handle in frustration. Let me try, says Connor, giving the torch back to Rose. But he can't open the door either. Where is the key for this bloody cupboard? Lily asks, but I suspect none of us know. The dog barks and scratches at the door again. Be quiet, Poppins! Lily shouts. She has the key, Rose whispers. What? Poppins has the key. Have you lost your mind? It's attached to her collar. Look! Rose says, shining the torch down at the dog. We seem to stare at Poppins for a long time before anyone says anything else. She blinks back in our direction, peering out from behind the two little plaits that keep her hair away from her eyes, looking a smidgen guilty, if I'm honest. But it doesn't seem rational, even to my irrational family, that an old English sheepdog could be behind everything that has happened here tonight. Rose bends down to remove the key from the collar. It's hard to see anything in the dim light, and it takes her a while to untie it. Hurry up! Says Lily. I'm trying my best, Rose replies calmly. When she finally removes the key, she slots it into the locked door and we hold our breath. We were all afraid of this cupboard as children. We knew that there were mice and cobwebs in there. I used to imagine a family of giant spiders living in the shadows, waiting to feed on anyone foolish enough to enter. Rose turns the key, and the door creaks as she slowly pulls it open. It's too dark to see inside. There was never a light. The rest of us peer over her shoulder from the imagined safety of the hallway as Rose steps forward, shining the torch. The first thing I register is the smell. Bad things happen when people die. The first thing I see is Nana. She's sitting on the floor of the cupboard, leaning against the exposed brick wall in the gloom. She would look like someone taking a nap in a cupboard if it weren't for the grey colouring of her skin, the giant bloody gash on her head, and the blood that has spilled all down her cheek and onto the shoulder of her white cotton nightdress. The piece of chalk she was holding when we first found her has been replaced with a pen and paintbrush, tied to her hand with a red ribbon. My father's body has been moved in here too, with his broken conductor's baton still tied to his right hand in the same way. It hovers in mid-air, presumably thanks to rigor mortis, as if he is conducting an invisible orchestra in the cupboard under the stairs. The surreal image creates a flashback in my mind, one I would rather not picture. I think it must have been early 1983. The third time I died was the first time I lied about it. My dad had a series of ornamental girlfriends after my parents parted company. They were almost always the same person, in my memory. Someone pretty and half his age who played in his orchestra. Men are infinitely more predictable than women, and the way my father behaved before and after the divorce was borderline clichéd. But there is really no telling what an angry woman will do. My mother stored up her anger until it was as much a part of her as we were. I don't think my sisters or Nancy took any of Dad's relationships with his musicians, mostly violinists, who I've always been suspicious of ever since. Seriously. They never lasted more than a few months. Until Rebecca. She was beautiful. And funny, and clever, and kind. Even now I can still picture her long blonde hair, pale skin and blue eyes. Perhaps because she looked so different from all of us with our darker family features. Rebecca encouraged Dad to spend more time with his daughters, taking us on trips to Thorpe Park and Madame Tussauds in the school holidays. She took us to McDonald's for Happy Meals, which, I confess, did make us happy. And she plaited our hair in ways we'd never seen before. We adored Rebecca. My mother did not. I can only imagine how awful it must have been when we came home beaming and full of stories about how wonderful Dad's new girlfriend was. Children can be so indiscreet. I was happy with the whole arrangement until the night my father was asked to conduct a special evening of music at the Royal Albert Hall. It was his life's ambition, and all of us, including Nana and Nancy, were invited to witness the momentous occasion. We had our own box to watch the performance of a lifetime, and we were allowed in early to have a tour of the concert hall before anyone else arrived. Lily hated the whole thing. She thought it was boring. And I always remember what she said that day. It was one of the only times I can recall my sister being genuinely funny, and the memory still makes me smile now. I'd rather he was a bus conductor. At least then we could get free rides. When Dad came to meet us, an hour or so before the show was due to start, he walked into the box with Rebecca. She was smiling and appeared to glow with happiness, and I noticed, despite being only 7, how her presence seemed to make my mother shrink into the shadows. "We have some news!" My father beamed at his first family. Rebecca held out her hand for us all to see, and I didn't understand the significance until she spoke. "Your dad has asked me to marry him, and I've said yes." I stared at the ring on her hand. Then I turned to my mother, who looked as though she had been punched. Her face was pinched tight, as if every muscle was working its hardest to hold her smile in place. Nana's mouth formed a perfect O. I had never seen what she looked like when surprised before. My sisters and I shuffled closer together, as though instinct told us our pack was under threat. Sometimes the thinnest of threads can tether people to one another, and that was always true in my family. Thoughts collided inside my head, bad ones, causing a series of small explosions. Until that moment, I think I always thought that my parents would get back together one day. We had all agreed that Rebecca was wonderful, but our opinion of her changed in a heartbeat. Now she was an awful, hateful witch of a woman, who I had adored only a few minutes earlier, because she was trying to destroy my family. I can remember my sisters spinning me round and round as a child, on the beach or in the garden, then telling me to try to walk in a straight line. It was impossible, and for some reason very funny to be that dizzy. We would laugh as I staggered and swayed all over the place before collapsing in a heap. But when I thought my dad was going to marry someone who wasn't my mother, I felt a very bad kind of dizzy. Then I felt sick. Then I fainted. I'm sure that's all it was. The Albert Hall was extremely hot, the box we were in was very high up, and the idea of my father remarrying caught me off guard. I just fainted. But Nancy was convinced my heart had stopped again, having literally been broken by Dad's news. An ambulance was called, and I was rushed away to hospital, along with the rest of the darker family women. My dad stayed with his orchestra and his fiancée. We never got to see him fulfill his dream on stage at the Albert Hall. And we never got to see him marry Rebecca. She broke it off 2 weeks later, saying that she couldn't be with someone who put his career before his child, even when they had been rushed to hospital. It was all my fault. And my heart didn't really stop that day. Not that I ever told anyone. It was the first time I understood that withholding the truth was almost, but not quite, the same as lying. And although I felt guilty about everything that happened as a result, I never confessed. You can get away with murder when everyone thinks you are dying.
Trixie!
Screams Lily, snapping me out of the memory. I turn to see where my sister is looking at the very back of the cupboard under the stairs and spot my niece curled up on the floor in the shadows. Her pink pyjamas are covered in dust and dirt. There are cobwebs in her hair. Her eyes are closed and her skin is so white she looks like a ghost. She doesn't move, even when Lily screams her name a second time. Trixie. Daisy Darker's niece was a precocious little child. Like all abandoned ducklings, she would not fare well in the wild. Aged 15, going on 30, Trixie Darker was clever and kind. But she asked too many questions, and some truths are hard to find. The child was unexpectedly chosen to inherit her grandmother's estate, a decision which caused much unhappiness and jealousy and hate. Her own mother felt angry and cheated. Most of the family felt the same. The child's father might have been happy for her, but nobody knew his name. Despite her endless questions, the child most wanted an answer to one. Who was her dad? Did he know she existed? Or would she only ever have a mum? When the time came, no one knew who to blame when she was found under the stairs. It's hard to know who to trust when a child is left for dead in the dust, wondering if anyone really cares. Chapter 22. 31st of October, 2:30 a.m. Less than 4 hours until low tide. Rose crawls inside the cupboard and gently pulls Trixie out. Nobody speaks, and the house is eerily silent. It seems strange to me that Lily doesn't rush to her daughter's side, but I think she must be in shock. We all are. Except for Rose, who takes charge of the situation again. She carefully lays Trixie on the parquet floor in the hall. "Hold the torch steady," she barks at Connor, leaning down over my niece and feeling for a pulse. It seems to take the longest time, but finally Rose nods. "She's alive."
"Oh, thank God,"
Lily says, but the smile soon slides off her face.
"Who did this?"
Nobody answers.
"Which one of you did this? She didn't lock herself in the bloody cupboard."
"Wait," says Rose. "She's alive, but something isn't right." We watch as she examines Trixie from head to toe. She's unconscious, deathly pale, and I notice that one of her socks is missing. Rose sees it too, and stares down at her bare foot. "There is a small amount of dried blood between her toes," Rose says, almost to herself.
"What does that mean?"
asks Lily.
"I can't be sure, but my best guess is that someone has injected her with something." "What? Who?"
"I don't know," Rose replies. "But we can't find Nancy. Your diabetic kit was in her bedroom, and your insulin pen is now missing from it." Lily shakes her head.
"You can't seriously be suggesting that our mother did this to Trixie. She loves her grandchild far more than she ever loved us."
Rose sighs and seems to visibly deflate. "Then where is Nancy now?
We don't have time for this. I need your diabetic kit."
Lily hands it to her, and Rose takes a small device from the bag. Nobody dares to ask what she is doing, and I feel as though we are all holding our breath. Rose pricks Trixie's finger and squeezes a tiny drop of blood onto the machine.
"I think she's been injected with insulin. If I'm right, we have to act quickly, or..."
"Just do whatever you need to do,"
Lily says in a quiet voice, and it is so strange to see her crying and vulnerable. She was always the indestructible sister. Rose runs to the library where she slept and returns with a bag of her own. It looks like an old-fashioned brown leather doctor's bag, a gift from Nana when Rose got a place at Cambridge to study veterinary science. She opens it, takes out a large needle and a small vial.
"What is that?" asks Connor.
"Glucagon. There should be some in Lily's kit, but that's missing too. It's the same treatment for dogs, so if I'm right, then..."
"What if you're wrong?"
Lily whispers. Rose ignores her and injects the drug into Trixie's arm. We wait for what feels like forever. Time seems impossible to tell. Then Trixie opens her eyes. They blink a few times before finding Lily.
"Mom? Oh, thank God. Thank you, thank you, thank you,"
Lily says, sweeping Trixie up in her arms and kissing her. I'm crying tears of joy and relief and love. Looking around, I see that we all are. Nobody who is here now would ever have hurt this child. A short while later, we are all back in the lounge, with a chair up against the door to prevent anyone coming into or out of the room. We have barricaded ourselves inside and added some logs to the fire for heat. Rose has lit some old candles for light. Even in the darkness, I can see that Lily is trembling. Trixie is by her side, wrapped in a blanket, staring at the flames. We don't have anything to eat or drink, but I doubt any of us have an appetite. It feels as though none of us want to acknowledge what is happening here tonight, as if maybe by not talking about it we can pretend it isn't. Nana and Dad are dead, and Nancy is missing. Either she did something very bad, or I fear something very bad has happened to her. The last thing Trixie remembers is drinking a cup of tea, which we all know contained one of my mother's sleeping pills, and Lily placing a blanket over her on the window seat. She doesn't remember being in the cupboard, or how she got there, or who locked her inside, or who she was in there with. All Trixie knows is that she went to sleep on the window seat, then woke up in the hall. I know that being completely oblivious about everything that happened in between is best for her, but it's frustrating and frightening for the rest of us. I think back to last night when we were all sitting around Nana's kitchen table, joking about how we would murder someone if we wanted to get away with it. Rose was the only one who said insulin between the toes. Seems like someone had the same idea as her and tried using it to kill my niece. I can't believe any of this is really happening and can't think of anyone who would hate my family enough to do this to us. I look around the room. Everyone in it had a reason to be upset with Nana because of the will. My mother and Lily both hated my father for a long time after the divorce, but nobody here would want to hurt Trixie. Surely I must be right about that. The power comes back on, making us all jump, and light floods the room. "Well, that's a good sign," says Lily. "Is it?" replies Rose, before examining Trixie again to make sure she is really okay. I can't help noticing the handgun in Rose's leather bag as she packs her things away, and I'm not the only one. Trixie's eyes are wide as saucers, and her face writes a question mark on itself. "Why do you have a gun, Auntie Rose?" she asks. "I thought you said that was somewhere safe," Lily says. Rose sighs at Lily. "It was, but after everything that has happened, I feel safer having it with me." She turns back to Trixie. "Sometimes vets need guns. They probably look a lot like the guns you see on TV, because they are, but vets use them for different reasons. It's very sad, but if an animal is seriously poorly, then..."
"You shoot it?"
Trixie asks. "Sometimes, but only if that's the only option, if the animal is in lots of pain." "Would you shoot one of us if we were in pain?" my niece asks without a hint of irony. "You should try to get some rest. We'll all leave as soon as the tide lets us. You're going to be okay, I promise." Trixie's face attempts a smile, but it doesn't take. She's old enough and clever enough to know that we haven't told her everything about what has happened here tonight. Rose goes to leave the lounge.
"Where are you going?"
Lily asks, sounding afraid.
"I'll be back in less than a minute. I just want to check something." "Do you want me to come with you?" Connor offers.
Rose stares at him for a long time, but leaves without giving a reply, which I suppose is an answer in itself. The rest of us sit in silence as the fire spits and crackles. Shadows dance around the walls and across our faces, the thoughts inside our individual heads so loud that I can almost hear them. Connor gets up to leave the room a few minutes later. I follow him, watch from the doorway, and see him standing too close to Rose out in the hall.
"Are you okay?" he asks her.
"No, of course not," Rose whispers back. "I came to get the key from the cupboard door," she says, patting the pocket of her jeans. "I think it's a master key. If I'm right, we can lock ourselves in the lounge until the tide goes out. Someone here tried to kill Trixie, and I don't think this is over."
"I think you're right."
"But who? And why?" "I don't know. But until we figure this out, we're all in danger," Rose says. "It started with Nana, so it has to have been someone who was upset with her. I don't think it was just about the will either.
Somebody trashed her studio looking for something, so my guess is it's someone who didn't like the idea of her writing one last novel about this family. Someone with a secret.
We all have secrets,
says Rose. Yes, but we don't all go around killing people in order to keep them. Rose stares at him when he says that, but Connor is too lost in thought to notice. Who had a motive to kill Frank? He continues. And why would someone try to kill Trixie? Did she see something she shouldn't have last night when she came downstairs and discovered Nana's body? Something which might identify the killer? Whoever it is, there's someone who likes to tidy things away, out of sight. Rose says, staring at the cupboard under the stairs. Connor opens the cupboard door a little wider. It still has all of our names and ages, and a ladder of a line with our heights written inside it. I read the top three. Daisy, aged 13, 5 feet 1 inch. Rose, aged 10, 4 feet 7 inches. Lily, aged 9, 4 feet 2 inches. It's the only place in space and time where I was ever taller than them.
At least we know where the missing bodies are, Connor says. And that explains why Poppins was scratching at the cupboard door. That dog could never bear to be away from Nana for more than a minute.
Rose closes the cupboard door and locks it.
I don't want to see what's in there anymore. And I don't want to talk about it.
They start walking back towards the lounge, and I retreat inside the room. I'm not sure why, but I'm glad they didn't see me. I feel like I'm missing a piece of the puzzle, and it's increasingly difficult to know who to trust. Everyone is afraid now, and they are right to be. Someone is killing the Darker family, one by one. And I fear it's only a matter of time until it happens again. Chapter 23 31st of October, 2:40 a.m. Less than 4 hours until low tide. Back in the lounge, Lily and Trixie are still sitting huddled together on the sofa, trying to keep warm. Rose slots the cupboard key into the lounge door, and she's right. It is a master key.
What are you doing? Asks Lily.
Locking us inside until the tide goes out. To keep us all safe.
But what about Nancy?
Lily asks.
She isn't safe. She's out there somewhere. She didn't just vanish. Am I the only one who cares about our mother and is worried about her?
Nobody answers.
Are we just not going to talk about it? I suppose that is what we normally do in this family, as though pretending something bad didn't happen will mean it never did. I know what you're all thinking, but Nancy wouldn't do this.
Do what? Trixie asks. She doesn't know what really happened to her. She doesn't even know that Dad is dead. As far as she knows, Nana had an accident and we're all just waiting for the tide to go out.
Maybe we shouldn't have this conversation in front of Trixie,
I say. But Lily ignores me. My sister is always a stranger to any point I try to make.
I've been thinking about everything that has happened tonight. And the only explanation is that someone else is here, at Sea Glass,
Lily says.
Someone else has been here the whole time, since before we arrived, waiting for us to go to bed and then picking us off one by one. Someone close to the family. Someone who knew about Nana's 80th birthday and that we'd all be here to celebrate it.
Everyone knew that Halloween was Nana's birthday. She made us celebrate it every year, says Rose. Connor nods.
And everyone knew that she believed it would be her last because of that premonition by the palm reader in Timbuktu.
Land's End, Rose corrects.
Whatever. They said her 80th birthday would be her last.
Which it was.
She was literally found in a puddle of her own blood just after midnight.
My niece starts to quietly cry.
I'm sorry, Trixie.
Connor says. That was very insensitive of me. This has been a terrible night for all of us. But you must be so upset about Nana and Frank.
Trixie frowns. What's wrong with Grandad?
Nothing. Lily lies. He's just very upset about Nana, so he's having a lie down.
Is Nancy having a lie down too?
Trixie asks.
Nobody knows what to say,
including me. But Lily isn't the only one to think that Nancy isn't responsible for any of the things that have happened here tonight. And she's right to be worried about her. My mother can be many unpleasant things, sometimes all at once, but a killer isn't one of them. I'm certain of that.
There is a picture on the mantelpiece above the fireplace, which I often find myself staring at. It's of three generations of darker family women. Nana, my mother, my sisters and me at Seaglass, posing like the happy family we rarely were, here, in this room. I'm guessing it would have been 1983, when I was seven, because of the matching blue dresses my sisters and I are wearing. I remember the day Nancy and I went to town to buy them. I lied to my mother that day, and I don't think she ever found out the truth. The trouble with little white lies is that they sometimes grow up to become big, dark ones.
Chapter 24 Seaglass, 1983. My mother always dressed up to go shopping. For her, it was like putting on a show. I remember that she was in a good mood that day. It was a rare and therefore memorable thing. Nancy sang along to the car radio as we drove along the coastal road into town, completely out of tune, to a song called Stayin' Alive. She had a video of a film that had the same song in it, something about a man called John Travolta who had a fever on a Saturday night. Her favourite shop in the whole wide world was called Debenhams, and that was where we were headed. We were at Seaglass for the Easter holidays, but Nana didn't come with us. She hated all forms of shopping. Material things only matter to material people, she would say. But Nancy loved to shop. The only problem with her spending habits and expensive taste was that we rarely had any money in those days. The divorce settlement was generous, but after paying the mortgage on our tiny house in London and my sister's school fees, there was very little left over, which was why the start of the sales was very important to Nancy. We had to get there on day one as soon as the shop doors opened, even if that meant queuing. The only thing my mother loved more than shopping was believing that she had paid less for something than it was worth. I loathed being dragged around department stores. They were too big, and I was too small, and I was always afraid of getting lost. I preferred the smaller shops we used to visit on our old high street. I always loved Woolworths because of the pick and mix. The memory of all those cola bottles, cherry lips and flying saucers still makes me smile. Lily's favourite shops were Our Price, where she went to buy the latest cassettes and music posters, and Tammy Girl and C&A, where she and Rose shopped for clothes. I always enjoyed our trips to Blockbuster Video, even if I was rarely allowed to choose which film we would rent, and visits to the little independent bookshop with Nana were my favourite outings. Buying books was the only form of shopping she ever enjoyed. It makes me sad to realise that none of those shops exist now. So many high streets are more like ghost towns these days. Nancy pushed through the crowds and headed straight up the escalator to the children's department in Debenhams, where she quickly chose two new dresses for Rose and Lily. I had to run to keep up with her walk, but I remember the navy blue velvet dresses with white collars, and how much I wanted one of my own. My mother always liked to dress my sisters in matching clothes, as though they were twins, but I rarely had anything new to wear. We went up another floor to women's fashion so that Nancy could buy a little something for herself. My mother always walked up the escalator in her hurry to find a bargain. The moving steps were very big,
and 7-year-old me found it difficult to keep up. I've been scared of escalators ever since. I always felt as though I was going to slip or trip or fall through the cracks. I had to jump when we reached the end to avoid the gap and certain death. On arrival in women's fashion, Nancy started to browse the reduced price clothes like it was a sport. I remember the ugly sound of hangers screeching across the metal rails. If other shoppers dared to get in her way, Nancy would tut until they moved. My feet started to ache in my second-hand shoes, which were pretty but too small. So, while I waited for Nancy to find the thing she thought would make her happy, I sat down and collected the coat hanger size cubes that had fallen to the floor. There were different colours for each size in those days. Orange for 10, green for 12, blue for 14. Nancy has almost always been a size 10, and I wonder if that's why I hate the colour orange. Everything was fine until we got to the changing room. My mother had taken in the maximum number of dresses to try on, but started to get upset almost right away because the first dress didn't seem to fit. "Just pull the zip up," she said, glaring at me in the mirror as I tried and failed to help. "It won't budge," I replied, tugging on the zipper, and she tutted and shook her head at me as though it was my fault. "There must be something wrong with the sizing of this dress," Nancy said, pulling it off over her head and dumping it on the floor. But the next dress, another size 10, didn't fit either. Nor did the next one. That's when Nancy started to cry. Having children ruined my body. Ruined it. The sacrifices I have made for you.
"I think you look beautiful," I said,
shoving my hands into my pockets, not really knowing what to say or do.
"I could just go and get you a bigger size."
I was so scared by the look my mother gave me then. I ran out of the changing room without waiting for a reply. Some of the size cubes I had picked up earlier were still in my pockets. Feeling them gave me an idea. I found the dress my mother liked the most out on the shop floor, went on tiptoe to select it in a size 12, then changed the green size cube on the hanger for an orange size 10. I ran back to the changing room. "I already tried that one," Nancy snapped, staring at the dress as though it had offended her.
"But maybe this one will fit," I said,
holding it out in both hands like a fabric peace offering.
"It did look very pretty on you."
She snatched the dress and started to pull it on. When I helped zip it all the way up at the back, she smiled at herself in the mirror. Then she smiled at me. I don't know whether Nancy ever looked at the size label sewn into the inside of the dress she bought for herself that day. All my mother ever really cared about was what was on the outside, what other people saw and how they viewed her. I still think it's a very sad way to live. But we stopped off in the children's department again before we left Debenhams that afternoon, and my mother bought me the same dress she had bought for my sisters. It was the first and only time she dressed me the same way as them. Sometimes, the things that make one person sad are the same things that can make another person happy. Nancy sang along to the radio again as we drove home. There were big bags full of half-price dresses in the boot of her little red mini, all of them with the wrong size on the hangers. I never told her what I did because sometimes keeping secrets is the kindest thing to do. I still remember how happy she was, until we saw a boy walking alone along the coastal path near Seaglass. I guess Connor would have been 13 at the time. That awkward stage where he still looked like a boy but was starting to think and behave like a man. He was limping. My mother pulled up beside him and gasped when she saw his face. He had a black eye and a bloody lip. "Stay here," she ordered, yanking the handbrake as though it were to blame. She got out of the car and rushed over to Connor. "Did your dad do this to you?" Nancy asked. Our whole family knew about Connor's dad, and my parents did not approve of Nana getting involved. They viewed spending what they saw as their inheritance on Connor's father's rehab as a waste of time and money. My mother had been waiting for the moment when she would be proved right. Connor looked away and stared at Black Sand Bay down below the cliffs. Nancy tried again, softening the edges of her words.
You don't need to say it out loud if you don't want to, but I do need to know what happened, Connor. Did your father do this to you? Nod or shake your head.
Connor stared at her, but he didn't move his head or even blink.
Jump in the back seat, she said,
and he did as he was told, sliding in beside me. He stank of blood and sweat. My mother was more than capable of hurting her own children behind closed doors, albeit only with words, but she could not tolerate the thought of any other child coming to harm. The car's brakes squealed as we pulled up outside Connor's dad's cottage, the one Nana had lovingly renovated a couple of years earlier. Sadly, people can be harder to restore than places.
Stay there, both of you, Nancy ordered.
She got out of the spotlessly clean Mini and tutted at the state of Connor's dad's blue Volvo. It was so dirty, I couldn't read the number plate, even though we were parked right behind it.
He's going to kill someone driving drunk along that cliff road one day, she muttered,
and I watched, with my face pressed against our car window, as Nancy marched up to Connor's house. I started whispering under my breath, waiting for my mother to strike like lightning.
One Mississippi, two Mississippi, three Mississippi.
I didn't have long to wait.
Open this door! Nancy yelled, banging her fist on it. My mother-in-law might have been taken in by you, but I know people like you never change. You are a disgrace of a man. Your son is sitting in my car looking broken, and I thought you might want to say goodbye before I take him back to Seaglass and make sure you never see him or hurt him again.
Nancy had fallen for Connor by then, just like the rest of the women in the Darker family. We all wanted to protect him. It was instinct. Not something any of us thought to question or knew how to explain. Like, if you found an abandoned puppy, you couldn't help wanting to protect him and give him a home. I looked at Connor, but he just stared at the floor of the car, his hands forming two little fists in his lap. The cottage door opened, and I could feel my heart beating so fast I thought it might burst right out of my chest. Then a man I didn't recognize appeared in the doorway. He looked like Connor's dad, but at the same time, he didn't. The man I had seen before was all too often a skinny, smelly, dirty man with torn clothes, a beard, and long hair. This man stood tall, with his head held high. His hair was neatly cut, his face was cleanly shaved. He'd put on weight, looked as though he'd been working out, and was dressed in clean clothes. I remember that his trousers and shirt seemed to have a ridiculous number of pockets, and I wondered what he kept in them all. He folded his tanned arms and smiled. The world seemed topsy-turvy as my mother, who thought she was the hero of this particular story, appeared to be in the wrong, while the baddie had become a calm, well-mannered, good-looking man.
Hello, Mrs. Darker, he said,
before inviting us all inside. It turned out that Connor's dad hadn't started drinking again, or hitting his son. I watched while he very slowly made some tea. He looked like a man who had never been in a hurry to do anything or get anywhere his whole life. Despite the slow motion, Mr. Kennedy had very much got his life back on track and was working as head gardener at a National Trust property a few miles away. That sounded good to me, but Connor said his dad was always careless with jobs and often lost them, even before his mother died. It turned out that Connor had been a little bit careless himself. He was getting into trouble at school and was in a fight with a boy 3 years older than him that day. I found out later that the boy had been spreading rumours about Lily and Rose, and Connor was defending them. Lily, who loved Easter because of all the chocolate, had promised to give some of the local boys a peek inside her panties in exchange for an egg. The bigger the egg, the longer they got to look. She was 11 years old. That was just the start of my sister getting a name for herself for all the wrong reasons in Black Sand Bay. My mother, thankfully, never found out the truth. Connor's dad opened a first aid kit, cleaned up his son's face, then served us all tea and biscuits in the kitchen. The house was just as clean and tidy as the man who owned it, and it was a surreal experience to see my mother lost for words. Even stranger to hear her apologise.
"I'm so sorry, I just thought that..."
"It's okay. I would have thought the same thing," Mr. Kennedy said with a polite smile.
"I was broken after my wife passed away, and I'm sorry for all the things your family had to see. That wasn't me, at least. Not the real me. I'm still grieving, but I feel more like myself again now. I'm so grateful for everything that your mother-in-law did for me, and my son, when times were tough. I've even started writing about it."
"A book?"
"Maybe. I haven't decided, and I don't know if it's good enough yet, but writing about it, the overwhelming grief, the drink, all of it, helps me to process what I became. And if sharing the experience, as awful as it was, might help others to not take the same path, or find a way back if they already have, then maybe..."
He turned to Connor.
"I hope you thanked Mrs. Darker for bringing you home."
"It's fine, and I told him to call me Nancy, so you should do the same."
"I've always liked the name Nancy. Perhaps we could start over. I'm Bradley. It's good to meet you."
He held out his hand, and my mother blushed when she took it. "I didn't know you were a gardener," she said, taking a sip of tea, anything to keep her hands busy and out of reach. "Maybe you could give me some advice for the little patch of land at the back of Seaglass?"
"I'd be happy to."
She blushed again. My mother-in-law was going to invite Connor to visit us on Easter Sunday. My older girls are home from school, and it's nice for them to spend time with someone their own age. Maybe you could join us too, if you're free.
"I'll check my diary," Mr. Kennedy said with a straight face.
When he smiled, and my mother realised he was joking, she laughed. I noticed again what a rare sound it was to hear. It was strangely beautiful, just like her. I might never have gone to school, but I felt like I learned a lot of valuable lessons that day, including that people aren't always what they appear to be. A middle-aged man with a drinking problem might just be a person poisoned by an all-consuming grief, while a middle-class woman with nice manners and nice things might just be a failed actress who can't handle being a dress size bigger than she wants to be. Life is a performance, and we don't all like the scripts we're given. Sometimes it's best to write your own. Connor and his dad did visit us at Seaglass that Easter. They wore suits and ties and brought chocolate eggs for the whole family. Mr. Kennedy spent a lot of time out in the garden with Nancy, and we listened to the sound of her laughing all afternoon. Bradley Kennedy never gave up drinking for good, but at that moment in time, he seemed to know when to stop, and he never laid a finger on Connor again. When I look at that picture of the Darker family women on Nana's mantelpiece now, I remember that Connor took it that Easter, using the Polaroid camera my father had given him. In the photo, Nana is wearing a pink dress and a purple Easter bonnet. Lily, Rose, and I are all wearing matching dresses for the first and only time. They are the navy blue velvet ones from Debenhams. Nancy is dressed in one of her Audrey Hepburn ensembles, and she looks very pleased with herself indeed. She is gazing just off camera. I think she was looking at Connor's dad. I smile too when I look at the image of her back then, because I was so proud of her for what she did that day, ready to stick up for Connor no matter what. She was protective of those she cared about. And if she loved something or someone, she loved them with all her heart. I just wish she had loved me that way. My mother might never have fulfilled her ambition of becoming an actress, but at least some of her dreams came true. She had a good life, a nice home, and a beautiful family. What happened a few years later was not her fault. Neither is anything that is happening now. Sometimes we have to let go of what we had in order to hold on to what we've got.